by Mike Burke, Dina Geister, Carla Wills, Tammy Warnoff, Libby Rainey, Sam Alcoff, John Hamilton, Robbie Karen, Hani Massoud, Tarina Nadura, Tamaria Studio, Maria Tarasena. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Shea.
KABU Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KABU in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KABU Community Radio's open meeting policy is available by calling the station at 503-231-8032. Meetings will be held at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue, Portland, unless otherwise noted. The Engineering Committee meets on the first Thursday of the month at 7 p.m. Please join us.
KABU Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Heal Right Workshop series for those who identify as Black, Indigenous, or a person of color.
The Heal Right Workshop series is an opportunity for emerging writers of color to connect, share, create, and constructively critique with others that can relate.
The workshops are on Saturdays from 10 a.m. to noon, and the deadline to register is September 6th, 2019.
Again, that's the Heal Right Workshop series for people who are Black, Indigenous, or POC. The deadline to apply is September 6th.
More information can be found at kabu.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This is KBOO Portland. It's 8 o'clock. KBOO programming is made possible by KABU member listeners and support from Portland Saturday Market. 46 years of American-made arts and crafts, freshly prepared international foods, local artisans, and local music in downtown Portland. Open every Saturday and Sunday in Waterfront Park, now through Christmas Eve. Event schedule, vendor information, and more at portlandsaturdaymarket.com.
Welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Today, we continue our two-part series featuring constitutional and public interest lawyer, public speaker, political activist, and educator Daniel Sheehan. Daniel Sheehan serves as the chief counsel of the Romero Institute, where he has advocated on behalf of the Lakota People's Law Project. He also teaches at the University of California, Santa Cruz, delivering lectures on climate change, the potential impeachment of Donald Trump, and the Standing Rock movement against the Dakota Access Pipeline, among others. Today, you will hear part two of Daniel Sheehan's Trajectory of Justice course, offered in 2019, focusing on Robert Mueller's report and the special counsel investigation. The special counsel investigation was an investigation of Russian interference in the 2016 United States elections and incriminating links between Donald Trump's inner circle and Russian officials. It was conducted by Special Prosecutor Robert Mueller from May 2017 to March 2019. Since July 2016, the FBI covertly investigated activities by Russian operatives and by members of Trump's presidential campaign using the code name Crossfire Hurricane. On May 2017, Donald Trump fired FBI Director James Comey. Within 8 days following a call to action by Democratic lawmakers and revelations by James Comey, Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein appointed Robert Mueller, a former FBI director, to take over the FBI's investigation. The investigation officially concluded on March 22, 2019, when the Mueller report was submitted to Attorney General Bob Barr, who many say misrepresented the report's findings. By July 2019, Mueller testified to Congress that Trump could be charged with obstruction of justice or other crimes after he left office. Since then, efforts to impeach Trump based on the Mueller investigation have floundered. Today, Daniel Sheehan discusses what the Mueller investigation missed and what he thinks is next for the future of Trump and the United States. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
I'm Max Pringle with these headlines. Hurricane Dorian Center is moving parallel to Florida's northeastern coast as it churns northward in the Atlantic Ocean. The storm's maximum sustained winds this morning are near 105 miles per hour, making it a Category 2 storm. Dorian is centered about 95 miles east-northeast of Daytona Beach and is moving about 8 miles per hour. Officials in South Carolina are preparing for the possibility of dangerous storm surge in the region. At least 7 deaths have been reported in the Bahamas from Dorian, with the full scope of the disaster still unknown. Hong Kong Chief Executive Carrie Lam has announced the government will formally withdraw an extradition bill that has sparked months of demonstrations in the city, bowing to one of the protesters' key demands.
First, the government will formally withdraw the bill in order to fully allay public concerns. The Secretary for Security will move a motion according to the rules of procedure when the Legislative Council resumes.
The bill would have allowed Hong Kong residents to be sent to mainland China for trials. It sparked massive protests that have become increasingly violent and caused the airport to shut down earlier this month. But Lan said the government would not accept other demands, including an independent inquiry into alleged police misconduct against protesters and for her resignation. However, she named 2 new members to a police watchdog agency investigating the matter. Protesters have also called for the release of those detained without charges, but Lan said this was unacceptable. Britain's parliament will attempt to defy Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Brexit plans today as lawmakers seek a way out of the impasse that's gripped the nation since the 2016 vote to leave the European Union. The House of Commons is confronting Johnson over his insistence that the UK leave the EU on October 31st, even without a withdrawal agreement to cushion the economic blow. Today, we'll consider a measure that will try to block a departure without a deal. Johnson said Tuesday he will seek a general election if the lawmakers succeed, taking his message directly to the people in his bid to deliver Brexit.
If MPs vote tomorrow to stop negotiations and to compel another pointless delay to Brexit, potentially for years, then that would be the only way to resolve this.
But it's unclear whether he will have the votes for such a move. Labour leader Jeremy Corbyn said he'd welcome a vote, but only after no-deal Brexit is off the table.
Get the bill through first in order to prevent, in order to take no-deal off the table.
On Tuesday, Johnson lost his first vote in Parliament since becoming Prime Minister in July and has seen his tenuous grip on power weakened by defections from his party that cost him working majorities. A total of 127 military construction projects are being sidelined by a Pentagon decision to shift $3.6 billion to build part of President Trump's border wall. Defense Secretary Mark Esper approved the transfer of funds on Tuesday. Officials say details about the projects losing their funding will be released after Congress is notified. The Pentagon comptroller says the projects are being deferred and not canceled, though there is no guarantee the funding will be restored by Congress. The money is to be used to build 175 miles of wall along the U.S.-Mexico border. Under withering criticism, the Trump administration is reconsidering its decision to end a program that allows seriously ill migrants to apply to stay in the country whilst they undergo life-saving medical treatment. Christopher Martinez reports.
The Trump administration's move to end the Medical Deferred Action Program came with little fanfare last week when people in the program began receiving letters telling them to leave the country within 33 days or else face deportation. That drew outrage from many Democrats, such as presidential candidate Joe Biden.
They're literally giving notice to these families that they got to unplug their kids and get them out of hospitals and take them out of America. What has that ever happened in the United States?
Other Democrats have also weighed in. East Bay Representative Marc DeSaunier has sent a letter to the Department of Homeland Security asking them to reconsider the case of a Concord resident from Guatemala who is getting treatment for a rare genetic disorder, treatment that is not available in Guatemala. The Trump administration says it will now reopen certain medical deferred action cases for people who have been sent denial letters. Congressmember DeSaunier has introduced a bill to help the Concord woman who is getting care under the program. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
And I'm Max Pringle. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
Those were our news headlines. And now we go to part two of Daniel Sheehan's Trajectory of Justice course offered in 2019, focusing on the Mueller investigation and Trump's connections to Russia. What did the Mueller team miss?
The last time we were together was the date of the release of the mildly redacted Mueller report. And we rushed in together last time to discuss as much as we could about it last time. And you will recall that there were just about four major important things I told you that you needed to remember about it as you listened to all of the discussions of the various people about it that were going to be taking place over the 5-day period or so before we got together again. The most important of all of these conversations that were taking place basically confirmed the things that we were saying last Thursday, even though we had only had a couple hours to take a look at it. The first one is that William Barr was just, it was referred to as a damnable lie on MSNBC, saying when he said that the refusal on the part of Robert Mueller to come to a finding about the obstruction of justice had nothing whatsoever to do with the internal White House legal counsel rule that you couldn't indict a sitting president. Barr was extremely clear about that in his 4-page report and then his report preliminary to releasing the document, the 400-page document, later that day on Thursday. And it's just transparently false. It's perfectly clear that that the proximate reason why Robert Mueller did not, in fact, charge Trump with obstructing justice was because of the White House legal counsel ruling. And he not only said that, but he went to great lengths to discuss that rule and pointed out, went further out of his way to point out that even though he wasn't returning any charges against Trump, criminal charges for obstructing justice, he wanted to make a point clear that a president could be charged criminally after he left office. And he went into great lengths about that and put footnotes in there and everything as kind of the roadmap to what could be done here. But then secondly, that William Barr had indicated that because Mueller had not come to any conclusion about the obstructing of justice, that he had intended to pitch it upwards to the Attorney General, William Barr, to make the decision himself. And so he then rapidly made the decision that there was, in fact, no evidence of obstruction, just as he had determined that there was no evidence of any collusion. That, too, is made transparently clear that that was a lie, because Mueller references over and over again the need for Congress to be the one to make the decision with regard to the obstructing of justice. And thirdly, when Barr kept using the phrase over and over again that they had found no evidence of any collusion or conspiracy, as he referred to it, and that's not true either, that there was ample evidence supporting a conclusion that the members of administration, after they'd gotten in, and of the campaign prior to their getting elected, were in fact coordinating with the Russians and were in regular communication with them, and that Mueller had gone to great lengths to point out all these different instances of contact and coordination and cooperation. What he said is that it wasn't clear that that amounted to the same thing as criminal conspiracy, and therefore he was leaving that up to Congress as well. Now, those are things that are perfectly clear in looking through the 428 pages, counting the appendix. So all four of those things that Barr was saying were completely false. And so what happened is the conversation began among all of the pundits and legal scholars and others, historians, over the weekend that went on over the entire Easter and Passover weekend, and various positions manifested, just as I told you they were going to. You had the extreme right-wing position of the Trump administration citing Barr to the effect that there was no evidence of collusion and no evidence of obstruction of justice. And then you had the regular Democratic Party, and that is with Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer and Joe Biden and the others, asserting that, well, look, obviously, Mueller had handed this up to the Congress to take a look at, so that's what we're going to do. We're going to look at it. We're going to decide what's in there. We're not, in fact, doing this under the auspices of impeachment. We're doing this just in order to find out what the report really says. So the first thing we have to do is get at all of the redacted portions, and then we have to get at all of the evidence, the actual interviews and things that that undergirded the conclusions that were come to. We talked about that last Thursday, that they were going to do that, and they did. And we talked about the fact that the progressives and the Justice Democrats and most of the new freshman Democratic House members were going to be calling for an immediate beginning of hearings under the official auspices of impeachment. And that has happened too. Now, one of the things that hasn't been given much attention, and I want to draw our attention to it here at the beginning of the discussion here on Tuesday, and that is that almost all of the pundits and clearly the regular Democratic Party people and even some portions of the progressive community have gotten conned into not talking about the collusion, that they're really still directing most of their attention to the issue of obstruction, and they've left the collusion alone. And I want to, before I get to our conclusion on this point, I want to point out that Lawrence Tribe, the author of To End a Presidency, when you're talking about outside sources, this is a very important book. This is Larry Tribe, the reigning top expert on American constitutional law in the world, the leading living constitutional law expert. In this book, he goes on at great length about all the nuances and challenges in doing an impeachment, recognizing that if the Senate is in possession of the other party, that it's unlikely that they will vote to convict, and all of the discussions that Lawrence Tribe was on, Ari Melberg, Melberg's show on Sunday, there was a special on MSNBC about the Mueller report. And in that discussion, Larry Tribe was on one side and Robert Bennett, another kind of major Washington fix-it lawyer, was on the other side. And Lawrence Tribe said that even in light of all of the nuances, all of the complexities, all of the challenges, that he set forth in his book, To End a Presidency, that based on a reading, he had read through it twice from cover to cover, the Mueller report, based on the unchallenged factual findings in this report that it was absolutely clear that the House of Representatives had a constitutional obligation to impeach Donald Trump. And then Ari Melberg asked Robert Bennett what he thought about that. And what he did is he mouthed the platitude of the regular Democratic Party and said, well, you know, as a matter of principle, that's probably right. He said, but, you know, by the time you get done going through the investigations, calling all the witnesses and choreographing all the public presentations, you're going to be right on the eve of the election itself. And it's going to be a lot better. It's going to generate an awful lot of pushback, an awful lot of hostility on the part of President Trump's base. It's going to be very disruptive to the American body politic, and it might be more advantageous just to go forward with the election and have him lose the election. And that would be much preferable. And Ari Melberg said, but Professor Tribe here has said that as a matter of absolute constitutional principle, you need to have articles of impeachment returned against him, or else it was going to establish an incredibly bad precedent of what it is a president was allowed to do, the lengths to which he or she could go to try to just protect themselves, to cover up crimes and things that they had engaged in, that you couldn't allow it as a matter of principle. And he went back to Robert Bennett, and Robert Bennett said, and I want you to remember this quote, there are many circumstances where we have to rise above principle. That's what he said. And in this case, he means constitutional principle, which means that there are instances where you need to ignore the Constitution of the United States. Now, this, of course, is a governing doctrine of right-wing people, that there are many circumstances where you have to rise above constitutional principle. In fact, almost every instance in which the Constitution becomes pertinent, they have an argument for why you have to rise above it. That's why the Constitution exists, because that's the inclination that all rulers have. They always say, what do you want to let? You want to let a criminal go? You want to let this person go? You know, yeah, we broke into his house in the middle of the night, and we searched through everything in his house and dug up his whole backyard, and we finally found, you know, an incriminating glove there. You know, and you know, what are you going to do, not let us put it into evidence just because we completely ignored the Constitution? You know, and if we let him go, it's going to be your fault. That's what they go through that thing all the time. And that's what Robert Bennett did. And so the issue is squarely put to us now about whether or not, despite all of the findings in here, it's going to be necessary to rise above constitutional principle and allow him to get away with it and just unelect him. Now, there was an additional argument. Rick Wilson, I guess his name is, a Republican, was being interviewed by Brian Williams on the 11th hour, and he went on at some length pointing out how if, in fact, the Democratic Party was foolish enough to try to impeach Trump, that could cause them to lose the election to Trump, because it would so animate his base, and it would so tire the American public with this ongoing discussion about all of this stuff all of the time, that they were going to resent it. And a lot of the people in the Democratic Party would not really vote for the people. And you have so many candidates going here challenging each other, they're going to start chewing away at each other and undermining why people should vote for any given one of them. And Trump is going to keep on coming. And therefore, it's actually probable, he said, that if, in fact, the Democratic Party choose, just as a matter of principle, he said again, to impeach Trump on this record, that in fact, they're going to be responsible for losing and having Trump be in office for four more years. Okay, so that everybody was coming forward over the weekend. Yes?
So, like, with that in mind, like, I think that's a fair argument. Can they not introduce the articles of impeachment after Trump wins?
After he, what?
After he wins.
Oh, yes. That's what happened with Richard Nixon. Richard Nixon won the 1972 presidential election. The break-in at Watergate happened in June of 1972, before the election in November. And what they did is they brought on the articles of impeachment against him, so that they could do that. The challenge of it is that they're leaving a person in power for virtually two full years by that time, for January of 2021. To be in power doing the things he's doing, okay? And that it would establish a precedent, as they said, is that they're going to leave you in if you do this, and that they'll try to beat you in the election. And so what it means is that if you were in your second term, you could do anything you wanted to do, okay? And so this is the way it's set. But now I want to make a very clear point. Because I want our conversations about all of this to be different than just all the talking heads. You can watch all the news shows and absorb everything that they're saying and can recite it like parrots, you know, if you want. But the idea here is to think more deeply about it and to think more carefully about it. And one of the major weaknesses in the impeachment effort, assuming it were going to be made by the Justice Democrats, is what people are saying is that the argument is going to be being made on Trump's side, among others. There's going to be two basic arguments. One is that how can you possibly have an obstruction of justice charge when there's no crime? So even if you have this separate offense of obstructing an investigation, what if the investigation turns up no crime? And so you haven't really done any harm. You haven't really harmed anything if you just obstructed the thing. It's kind of a technical thing. Yeah, you didn't tell the truth to the FBI, but there wasn't any truth to really conceal. And so the fundamental question keeps repeating itself. What is the underlying crime? What is the underlying crime that was causing them to lie all the time? Why is it they were lying about their contacts with Russia? Why is it that they were lying always about the meetings with Putin and the meetings with the foreign secretary and the ambassador? Why is it that they were doing that? And now there are four basic theses or theories of this that I want to touch on, because we want to be discussing this in the context of the purpose of this course. The first one is, of course, that the fundamental thing to try to conceal was the fact that Trump and his people were meeting with the Russian intelligence agents, and they were feeding them detailed polling data, specifically about Michigan and Wisconsin and Pennsylvania. This place that kind of stunned the country, where these states that are typically Democratic presidential states all of a sudden shocked everybody late into the night and went for Trump. And yet they found the exact information is that when Manafort was meeting with Kryzniak and the other guys, when he met with the fellow at the cigar store, he was actually handing him polling data specifically about Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania. But what they haven't been able to find so far is, what did the Russians do with that? Did the Russians do anything specific with regard to Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, and Michigan that actually changed the outcome of the election? That's that type of thing that they're looking for. That's what they would consider to be the smoking gun. And what you'll notice is in the Mueller report, he said, they never investigated that. They never tried to find out what, if anything, the Russians did with that particular information. And they handed that investigation off to the FBI. Okay? So that's an important thing to keep in mind. So there is still an active investigation going on by the FBI into theory number one, in that they seem to believe that unless they can prove that the Russian intelligence actually did something with that specific kind of information that they got about the polling data from those three states that flipped those states for Trump, that if you try to prosecute without that proof and without that evidence, you're going to come up short. And the American people are going to say, hey, no harm, no foul. You know, that so they gave him some of the polling data. Who knows? We don't know that that caused anything. All of the Trump supporters will say it didn't have any effect at all. You know, and unless you can prove that it did, you know, you're left hanging in the wind. And very importantly, you need to understand that there is going to be mounted here, and you just heard a little bits about it so far, there's going to be mounted in the Senate whether or not they impeach Trump and whether or not they go up to the Senate to have a trial of Trump. The Senate Intelligence Committee is going to be digging into the origins of the investigation. They're going to be digging into this. And I've asked you, and I don't want to embarrass you, but I'm going to, how many of you have read or watched the two parts that I asked you to see? To look at those, that two-part thing. Okay, so I want to ask you again, come on now, I want you to participate in this thing. I want you to look at that. It's simple. You just go to it. It's right on the internet. You just look up the Epoch Times, E-P-O-C-H, the Epoch Times Spygate. That's all you have to do. Just put it in Google, and up it'll pop, and it'll be there. It's three parts now. They've supplemented it. And what they're doing is they're laying out in the United States Senate Intelligence Committee, no doubt whatsoever, is going to track that. And they're going to be asserting that the deep state, that's the national security state apparatus, CIA, NSA, DIA, that all of these different intelligence agencies had it out for Trump, including the FBI. And that they, from the minute that he stunned everybody and won the election, that they were out to unseat him. And that they fabricated this information and evidence against Trump. And that they came up with this cockamamie theory that was charging Trump with being a secret agent for Russia. Okay? And that they've got this 75-minute, I guess 35-minute and 45-minute, like this 80-minute a documentary, that, as I told you before, of the, say, roughly 400 data points in the thing, probably 375 of them are completely true. And that they've strung them together in this narrative that when you look at it, and it's highly sophisticated, very professionally presented, and very expensively produced. When you look at that, you come away going, well, okay, I see what they're saying. And what they're asserting is that the deep state has an agenda, which is a one world agenda. It's the thing that George Soros and the Rockefellers are all behind, that they're trying to bring the entire world together under one single government, like the United Nations. They're the ones that are pushing the EU, the European Union. They're the ones that are pushing, you know, NATO and these trade agreements, NAFTA, the Pacific Trade Agreement. They're pushing all of these things, the World Court, the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund. There's an entire set of apparatus that they're putting into place to try to have a one world government so they can control it. This rich elite, 1%, are going to be running the world. And it harkens back to Steve Bannon.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. We're going to take a short station break. When we return, we'll hear more from Daniel Sheehan's Trajectory of Justice course on the Mueller investigation and Trump's connections to Russia, what the Mueller investigation missed. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
It's 8:33. This is KBOO. Coming up at 9 o'clock, it's Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, Per Fogering fights the umpire. 10, It's Heather McCoy. At 11, on Between the Covers, David Naiman speaks with the author of The Trojan War Museum and other stories. And at 11:30 on Black Book Talk, Multnomah County Library staffers LaFoster Williams and Milo Reed will share their favorite reads. Don't forget that you can hear all of these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or iTunes or Google Play. And if you want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programs, then download our mobile app. It's 8:34.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Check us out on our website at sotrueradio.org. If you are on Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. And we're also on SoundCloud. Look for us there, Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. On Twitter and Instagram, you could find our handle at SoTrueRadio. And today we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Detroit, Michigan. And internationally, we would like to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in Hong Kong. We now turn our attention back to part two of Daniel Sheehan's Trajectory of Justice course offered in 2019, focusing on the Mueller investigation and Donald Trump's connections to Russia.
And Steve Bannon's kind of peculiar mishmash of intellectual work and reckless guesswork that he engages in, where he's got this bizarre theory. That he and Trump are really representing the regular people, the kind of great unwashed. That's why Bannon runs around looking like he hasn't shaved for 3 or 4 days, and rumply clothes, looks like he slept in them for a week, etc. And he's trying to appeal to what he, in a caricature form, thinks regular people are like, and that he's a champion. He and Trump are champions of these people, despite Trump's tax break, you know, that gave you know 87% of all the benefits from the tax break to the richest 1%, you know, et cetera, and the statistics on that tax program he's got, and yet they're making this argument that Trump and Bannon and the others are champions of the regular people, and that they're opposing this one world government, this globalization process of the Soros and the Jewish bankers, and they say it. I mean, they basically say it. They're constantly referring to George Soros, you know, and winking at everybody about, well, you know, George Soros is, you know, this is the counter thesis that is going to be set forth by the Trump administration and by the Senate, the Republican dominated Senate. So that they're going to have, in any trial that takes place in the Senate, they're going to have not only the blocking action of beating down every single affirmative piece of evidence that you've got by saying that, you know, you can't really prove that. You can't really show that they had this intent or that. And then they're also going to have what a great defense has is an affirmative alternative narrative of what it is that's really going on here. And so they're going to give cover to the senators to be able to say, well, I heard the two arguments, you know, and I couldn't really decide between the two of them. They're going to take the dodge that they falsely attributed to Mueller. I heard both narratives, and I couldn't really decide beyond a reasonable doubt. And so therefore, I didn't vote to convict him. Okay, and then that's what the argument is going to be. So this argument that somehow Trump and his campaign colluded with Russia to get Trump to win the election swings into the first theory on them having actually manipulated the data in Michigan, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, or else it falls short. Now, there's a second thesis, however, which is that Trump didn't really think he was going to win, just like everybody else. He didn't believe he was going to win. And so what he was doing is using his campaign as a big marketing device. And what he was doing is he was earning goodwill with Russia by constantly saying things about how he was going to take the sanctions off Russia. He was going to be developing things with Russia. He was going to build the Trump Tower in Moscow. What he was doing is he was using the campaign and the nomination of the Republican Party to basically increase the value of the Trump brand. And that he ended up finding out that he surprised himself that he won. And that that's why he wasn't prepared. And he was scrambling all around, just picking people at random to fill things, and wasn't being really careful, had no plan really in place at all, except for his big swaggering ego. And that really explains it. And on the face of it, it has a lot of appeal, because people are all saying, well, I sure didn't think he was going to win. You know, unless he's not only a troll, but that he's stupid. In addition to that, he probably thought he wasn't going to win. And so it has a certain facial appeal to it. And so that it's the argument that, you know, always prefer being convicted of being a fool rather than being a knave, as they say. So rather than being a criminal that was basically, you know, setting up as a traitor for the Russians, he was just inept, like he is in most everything. And therefore, even though he was a fool, even though he was inept, even though he was naive in the face of what Russia was doing, you can't really impeach him for it. Now, you may want to make an argument as to why should you want him to be president if he's that stupid, but you know, but that's a separate argument. Okay. So now the third theory that you're going to run into, being proffered by people to be adopted by the Senate and the Republicans against them, is that Trump has a history of loans that he's been getting from the oligarchs, that he had run out of a credit in the United States after his third filing of bankruptcy, after the third time that he sent all of his creditors, you know, running with a penny on the dollar after one thing after another, like his Atlanta casino and the other things, and that. Therefore, he had this long series of loans that were outstanding to the oligarchs. And also, very importantly, that the oligarchs were, and this all goes to the question of what is the crime that he's trying to hide, okay? And so what they do is they proffer this as an alternative because it gets away from him plotting with the Russians, you know, to simply do their bidding because he's a Russian agent, okay? What it really is he's gotten himself beholden to the Russian oligarchs because they, through the bank in Greece, the bank in, Cyprus, right. There's the bank in Cyprus where the oligarchs store all kinds of their embezzled money. And so when he couldn't get any loans for new building projects in the United States, he went to there. And he started getting massive loans at extraordinary rates for building huge new projects. Okay. And so what was happening is the oligarchs were laundering their money. They would put the money into the bank, and then the bank would loan it out to Trump to build one of these gigantic buildings. He would then turn around and sell all the condos in the buildings, then repay his loan, and then it was laundered. The money was clean. It was back into the bank. And so it was a big money laundering scheme for the oligarchs. And there is additional evidence in support of that because he repeatedly would, for example, when he would build one of these condominium towers, say there are 100 condominiums in it, he would sell like 6 or 8 of these condominiums to a Russian oligarch. And the Russian oligarch would buy them for like $6 million apiece. And then he would turn around right within a month and sell all of them for $5 million, which is money laundering. Again, they're laundering their $6 million and they're getting $5 million in clean money back for each condo, and Trump is facilitating that. And you have the other one where he bought the big estate, one of the big estates down in Florida. And he bought it for, I guess, like $4 million or $5 million or something like this. And one of the Russian oligarchs came along and gave him $40 million for it. You know? And so there you go. And so what I'm saying is that there is this third theory that in fact, Trump was not a Russian spy, a Russian agent. What he was is a guy who got himself into trouble by becoming beholden to these people, these oligarchs, and he got to be friends with them, and so that he had developed this kind of friendly relationship with them. And that's the proximate reason why he was doing what he was doing, because he was friends with them. And then there's, of course, number four, there's the P videos, the famous P videos, which turn out not to be as licentious as you first thought. And I won't go into great detail about this, but it turns out that it's not much of a defense, but it wasn't that he had hired prostitutes to pee on him, the famous golden shower that they talk about all the time. What he was doing, they assert, instead, is he hired the prostitutes to pee on the bed in the ambassador suite, the presidential suite at the big gigantic hotel there in Moscow where he was staying, because that's the bed where Obama had slept with Michelle. And that he wanted to just insult them by doing that. And it was videoed by Russian intelligence. And so that in theory, they had that over him, that they could humiliate him, they could play that tape. And so therefore, he felt like he was being blackmailed, not only for that particular tape, but it turns out there's another one over in St. Petersburg that involved him with prostitutes. And that this is one of those kind of cheap shots that can be appreciated by almost everybody, because they could see how a person would be really humiliated and embarrassed by these kind of things. And so therefore, it put him in this kind of condition where he was going to be doing favors for them to keep them from releasing this. Now, those four theories that have been bantered around or bandied around are all things that the three of them go to counter this charge of evil traitor that he was. It just indicates that he was beholden to them. He'd gotten into a relationship with them. You know, this is the scenario that they want to counter, and so that they know that if they're going to prosecute him, if the Democratic House Judiciary Committee is going to prosecute Trump for in an impeachment article in the Senate, they've got to have a single thesis. They can't say, well, he did this or he did that, or the reason he did it was this. You know, that isn't going to work. You can't throw multiple charges like this at him and have them sell. And so but what it is that it turns out that there's evidence that the special prosecutor has missed entirely, and that it's not in any one of the 428 pages, which is the real reason why he was acting the way he was toward Russia. Now, this is the part where you're saying, what is that, right? What's going on here? Is there something that nobody seems to know about? The answer is yes, okay? And the secret to this takes place in April of 2016. This is before the Republican convention, before he has the nomination. It's before his election. And what he does, he's getting ready to deliver his first speech on foreign policy. And it's scheduled to be held in the National Press Club in Washington, D.C. And suddenly, on the 25th of April, the speech was scheduled for the 27th of April. Suddenly, on the 25th of April, a decision is made to change the venue from the National Press Club over to the Mayflower Hotel. And it turns out that the sponsor who rented the Mayflower Hotel for that speech was the Center for the National Interest. The Center for the National Interest is a group that was founded by Richard Nixon and his Secretary of State, Henry Kissinger. Henry Kissinger is the honorary chairman of the Center for the National Interest. They had this meeting on the 27th of April, and prior to the actual speech being delivered, they had a closed door VIP cocktail party. And there were only 240 people invited to that particular cocktail party. And at that cocktail party was, in fact, the Russian ambassador and the ambassador from Italy, which no one could imagine why he was there, and also the ambassador from Singapore was there. And what happened is they had a series of meetings that took place there during that that cocktail hour, in which they made a deal that the largest Russian oil corporation, the Russian state-owned oil corporation called Rosneft, R-O-S-N-E-F-T, Rosneft was going to be sold to private stockholders. And it was going to be an $11 billion sale. And it had to do with selling the oil and natural gas interests, not only under the Caspian Sea, natural gas, the Black Sea, the petroleum, but also the Arctic shelf in the Arctic, which depended upon global climate change having to continue to go forward. Because if the global climate change continued to go forward, would raise the temperatures, melt the ice, and give them access to those shelves. And Russia claimed those shelves, and they had set up a deal in which they were agreeing to sell a one-third interest in all of that oil to ExxonMobil. And that is why Rex Tillerson, who was the CEO for ExxonMobil, was given the Russian Order of Friendship Medal by Putin in April because of that sale being closed. And that they're anticipating 87 billion barrels of oil under the arc and the Arctic shelf, and it's going to end up generating some $500 billion in profit. And this information is being missed entirely by the special prosecutor. The special prosecutor in volume one on page 103 has this kind of innocent conversation about the Mayflower Hotel cocktail party. The only issue that he was looking into is whether or not the conversation that was had between Jeff Sessions and the Russian ambassador at that cocktail party really entailed a lot of substance or not, or whether it was kind of a casual hello, how are you, or they may have said a little something about it. But the fact of the matter is there were intense conversations going on among numerous people that were in the Trump administration, and here they all are, right here, all having conversations about lifting the sanctions. Because unless they lifted the sanctions that had been imposed by Obama over the intrusion into Crimea by Russia, and then later in January by Obama for the meddling in the election, the Obama administration imposed sanctions on Russia that specifically prohibited the buying of the oil. And so that what they were doing is they were, in a sense, freezing in place not only global climate change with the kind of rulings that Obama made, like ordering the stopping of the pipeline for the Dakota Access Pipeline in North Dakota and stopping the Keystone XL pipeline, which Trump was a partner in. Trump was a partner in the Energy Transfer Partner Corporation, as was Rick Perry, whom he chose to be his Secretary of Energy. Okay, and he also chose as his head of the EPA, he chose the fellow who was the Attorney General from Oklahoma, Scott Pruitt. Okay, and so that you find his his entire cabinet filled with people that are all involved with this, including his Secretary of Education, DeVos, who is the sister to Eric Prince, who is the founder of Blackwater International, that spun off Tiger Swan, private military corporation, that was deployed in North Dakota against the people that were protesting the Dakota Access Pipeline. So what you see happening there all at one time is this decision that they're going to, Trump administration is resolving that they're going to go pouring forward with this massive increase in the amount of oil that is being produced for sale in the world. And he's going to lift the sanctions against Russia to open up the Arctic shelf, which is dependent upon more global climate change taking place, in order to make that of any real value. That's what's going on here. And that these people are all involved, and they're going to be making billions and billions and billions of dollars of personal profit, all the people that are involved in this, right? And very interestingly, there's a person who shows up at that VIP cocktail party, who I'll get you a picture of. People may not recognize who he is, but anyway, it's Bud McFarlane. Bud McFarlane shows up at that meeting. Bud McFarlane was the national security advisor for Ronald Reagan in the Iran-Contra thing. He was indicted by the special prosecutor, and he was pardoned by George Bush Sr. at the direct advice of William Barr, who was his attorney general at the time. Okay? And so that here, what you're looking at here is this cadre of people, and in McFarlane, when he shows up at that conference, the discussion is the speech that is being given by Trump is asserting that he wants to drop the sanctions against Russia, that we can be better friends. And what it actually says, what McFarlane says when quoted there is, quote, "Russia is going to be an integral partner of the United States in ensuring the energy security of the Western world." Okay. This tracks all the way back to George Bush Sr. and Dick Cheney and the people that were there in the Defense Department that were all there back in the Reagan-Bush administration. Okay? Because what happened, you remember what happened, is as soon as Russia, under Gorbachev, I guess I better back it up because there's a whole lot of stuff that you're never going to hear about otherwise, unless you hear it here, that when I was at the Jesuit headquarters in Washington, D.C., we did the Karen Silkwood case. We litigated the Karen Silkwood case up in Oklahoma, where Scott Pruitt later became the attorney general. Big, huge oil state up there. The Kerr-McGee Petroleum Corporation basically runs the entire state of Oklahoma. The Robert S. Kerr of Kerr-McGee is the four-time governor of the state of Oklahoma and the four-time United States senator, and was the chairman of the Senate Armed Service Committee. And he owned and built the facility at Cimarron, Oklahoma, that was designed to reprocess the spent nuclear fuel in all of the other 103 private nuclear facilities in the United States. One of the major challenges of the nuclear power, other than it being so dangerous that it was like lighting your cigarette with a blowtorch to generate electricity, that what it was is it was contaminated. If the contaminant got loose, would contaminate people all around it. What happened when we won that case against the Kerr-McGee Corporation, Petroleum Corporation? Because the secret, one of the many secrets is that you don't probably know, is that virtually all of the private nuclear facilities are all owned by petroleum companies. They view it as the future source of monopoly-controlled energy once oil runs out.
We're out of time. Today's show produced by me, that's Margaret Prescott. I'd like to thank the Sojourner Truth team, including assistant producer Romero Funes and our engineer, Kiana Williams. I'd also like to thank the Global Voices for Justice, who brought us and made available to KPFK the Daniel Sheehan course. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can contact the Pacifica Radio Archives at 1-800-735-0230 or go online to pacificaradioarchives.org. And remember, you can visit our website, sotrueradio.org, and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at SoTrueRadio. Thank you for listening. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow. This is your host, Margaret Prescott.
This is KBOO Portland. The time is 8:59. Coming up after these messages, next it's Press Watch, Teresa Mitchell's weekly look at the news you're not supposed to know. At 9:30, it's Fight the Empire with Parafaggering. And at 10, it's the Heather McCoy Show. At 11, on Between the Covers, David Naiman speaks with Aissa Papaitia Bukak, and I apologize for my pronunciation of that, author of the Trojan War Museum and other stories. And at 11:30, Black Book Talk, Multnomah County Library staffers LaFoster Williams and Milo Reed will share their favorite reads. Don't forget that you can hear all these programs after they air on KBOO.fm or on iTunes and Google Play. And if you want a third way to listen to all your favorite KBOO programming, then download our mobile app today.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Project Northwest on Friday, September 6th at 10 p.m. at the Atlantis Lounge inside Mississippi Pizza in Portland. Project Northwest is a local zine that helps promote local hip-hop and R&B artists with an emphasis on showcasing artists that identify as Black and POC, LGBTQIA+, women, and artists who experience disabilities. Again, that's Project Northwest on Friday, September 6th at 10 p.m. at the Atlantis Lounge inside Mississippi Pizza, 3552 North Mississippi in Portland. This is a 21 and over event. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.